Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction that my mother would have loved. And for welcoming me to the beautiful Beijing Language and Culture University. It is a great honor to be here and a great pleasure. I've been looking forward to it, and I've already had a wonderful time talking to the students here at this university. So some of you are new to the crowd, and I'll give just a brief introduction to a couple of things that I've put in place earlier. I've been talking about the way in which human beings are exceptionally creative, how we're distinguished from other species in having an advanced form of the ability to integrate mental structures, conceptual structures, and how this produces the kind of innovation that we find uniquely in our species, how it makes culture possible, and how it makes language possible. A good topic, therefore, for the Beijing Language and Culture University. And I will give just a little taste of this kind of operation. It's called conceptual integration, and conceptual integration is when you have two different mental arrays that you're able to integrate selectively into one with emergent properties. So suppose this little yellow circle is a representation of a man's thought about the fact that he is participating in a wedding. He's a groomsman, and he's helping with the wedding. And so in this mental space, there's the bride, there's the groom, and there's the official, and they're on the grass overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And he's doing his job. He's in this wedding frame. He knows his role. But at the same time that he's doing this, quite amazingly, he is also thinking about the fact that 3 weeks ago, he was diving with his girlfriend off Cabo San Lucas, down in Mexico. And she's not here now. They were diving for treasure, right? Now, it is already an amazing problem for cognitive science that he would be able to think of these two things simultaneously. Shouldn't he get confused? What use is it to him to be thinking about diving with his girlfriend in Cabo San Lucas, right? But notice he doesn't get confused. He does not swim down the aisle, even though in his memory he's swimming. He does not have difficulty speaking, even though in his memory he's got an apparatus in his mouth. He does not mistake the bride for a shark, right? And he doesn't think his girlfriend is actually here. This is such a big problem that cognitive psychologists like Arthur Glenberg and cognitive scientists like Terry Deacon have dedicated their research to trying to figure out why we should be able to do this at all. But for the moment, let's just take that for granted. The next thing he can do is make mental conceptual connections between these two things. So, for instance, there's an analogy connection between his girlfriend and the bride, right? And he can do more. He can project selective structure from each of these two things, and this is the important part, the green circle, to a blend. And in the blend, this actually should be green. And in the blend, now, he can be running a simulation in which he is getting married to his girlfriend here. He's imagining this. Now notice, marriage to the girlfriend is not in the space with the wedding, and it's not in the space with the diving. It's emergent structure. It's new. In fact, he may have never thought of it before, but he can combine selectively these two things and have emergent structure. And he can think about whether or not this is a good idea. Now, we've talked already quite a bit about the way in which this makes it possible for language to use a relatively few forms to talk about almost anything. So here's an example I haven't quite given before. In English, there's a clausal structure called the ditransitive. Now, you all know about the transfer of something. So if I pick up something and I hand it to somebody, that's a very basic mental scene. And she hands it back to me, see? And I hand it back to her again. And you should watch little children when they're playing, because they'll hand it and hand it back. Would you like it? And they take it and you say, may I have it? And they give it back to you, see? It's very human scale, the ditransitive. Hand, for example, is a verb for this in English, give. Very basic human scene. But there's also a clausal structure that is associated with the ditransitive. Noun phrase, verb, noun phrase, noun phrase. So I say, I handed her the eraser. Noun phrase, verb, noun phrase, noun phrase. I, noun phrase, hand, verb phrase, her, noun phrase, the eraser, noun phrase. Now, that's a very basic human scene, very compact. We understand it very well. But I can take all kinds of things that we do not understand very well, that are very diffuse, and integrate them with that scene into a blend that now has ditransitive structure. So here, over here, we have an agent who acts. There's maybe a causal relation. Maybe somewhere there's a recipient, there's more reception, there's a patient thing received, and so on. But as Adele Goldberg points out, we can now use this ditransitive notion that's attached to this clause to say she granted him his wish. Noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, noun phrase. Right? Even though it's not an actual physical transfer. But it's got the structure. It's got some of the structure of the physical strength. She gave him that premise in an argument. She allowed him that privilege. She won him a prize. She bequeathed him a farm. Now think over time and space how diffuse that is with how many agents. Bequeathed means I leave it in a will and then you get it after I die, right? That's a long time. But here down in the blend, it's like handing you something right here. And in using this clause form, I am asking you to use that kind of frame, that kind of conceptual frame, to grasp a network, a big network, that is diffuse and not so easily grasped. She gave him a headache. Notice, she can give him a headache even though she doesn't have one. In the ditransitive scene, if I give her the eraser, it's because I have one. But now, under selective projection, I can ask you to use the ditransitive, the idea of giving. But in the blend now, it doesn't mean I had to have it in order to give it to you. She gave him a headache. She showed me the view. She told me a story. She denied him the job. Now notice, you can use the ditransitive clause with a verb that means stoppage. The ditransitive clause is handing, is making it all the way go through. But the verb deny or refuse is opposed to that. But no problem. You can now put them together into a scene in which she did something that had a causal effect on the transfer of something to him, and what she did was stop it. In the blend now, it is not completed because blending is selective. Only some things come down from the input spaces, and there's emergent structure in the blend. This gives us the capacity for emergent structure. Now, one of the great things that blending does for us is create compressions. It takes things that are very decompressed and unpacked that we couldn't understand because we don't have minds built to work in that way. We work at human scale. But it creates a human scale package, a human scale compression that we can handle, and this lets us hold on to the big conceptual network because we have a human scale anchor. We have a human scale compression, a platform that conceptually we do understand, and we can work from there. How do we get these compressions? Well, one way to get them is to use as an input something that's already compressed. This is called borrowing a compression. And borrowing a compression borrows constructions. This is what you just saw in the ditransitive. The ditransitive of handing something to somebody is already compressed. It's already at human scale, and it comes with a linguistic construction. Noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, noun phrase. Down into the blend comes that compression and the construction with it. So now you can use it of the blend. Here are some examples. I say, you are digging your own financial grave. Okay? Now, in the space of digging a grave, there's one agent with one instrument who uses that instrument in the same way again and again. Repetitive action to produce a result. It's at human scale. Now, over here, imagine this is a conservative father saying to his adult son who's investing, and the father thinks that the investments are unwise and will produce bankruptcy. And the father says, son, you are digging your own financial grave. Now, over here in the financial space of investing, there's a huge clash with digging your grave. In the space of digging the grave, the reason that grave is dug is because somebody dies. But over in the space of the finances, the reason you go bankrupt is because you invested. So it's not the person who's digging the grave who dies, but it is the person who's doing the investing who goes bankrupt. So there's a big clash in the causality. They're inverse in the two scenes. Moreover, people do not dig graves without knowing that they're digging graves. But the whole reason of talking to the son is that he doesn't realize that he's digging his own grave. He doesn't realize that he's going to go bankrupt. He doesn't understand what he's doing. In digging the grave, the participant structure is the person who digs the grave is not the person who dies, but over in the financial scene, the person who does the investing goes bankrupt. So you see, there's this enormous clash. This is a double scope blend. There is a clash between the frame structure, it means the top organizing conceptual structure of the two separate mental spaces, but this does not stop us from putting together a coherent human scale blend. On the contrary, that's what we're specialized to do. There was luckily we already heard from Professor Dirk Gerhardt that about Clinton's difficulties with Monica Lewinsky. When he was first starting to have these difficulties, he was just brushing them off. There was no problem. There was no scandal for him. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and somebody in the Washington, D.C. area said, and it got printed in the newspaper, if Clinton were the Titanic, the iceberg would sink. That's because the movie Titanic was brand new at that time. Newspapers often do this. Because things are active. Two things come up and you blend them. You're just very good at this. And notice, you understand this very well. Now notice, the one thing you know about the Titanic is that it sank. Okay? But in the blend, it doesn't sink. The one thing you know about an iceberg is that ice is less dense than water, and it can't sink. It can be submerged, but it can't sink. But in the blend, we now have new kind of physics. Ice can sink, and the reason it can sink is because Clinton is so powerful, right? Notice that the causality comes from the target, not from the source. You have often heard about metaphors that the causal structure, that the inferential structure comes from the source. That is, in principle, false. That's not the only way in which a metaphor can be put together. These are clearly metaphoric or felt to be metaphoric. And it's quite clear that digging the grave is the source and that the Titanic and the iceberg are the source. But it is not the case that the main inferential structure, the causal structure, participant structure, intentionality, and so on, come from the source. No, they come from the target by selective projection and are built up. Now, this happens routinely. The point is we borrow a compression, and it borrows a construction, and this creates human-scale, understandable blends that help us understand the network. Now, there's another way. I'm being very simplistic here, but in the main, there's another way to get a compression in the blend. And we've seen this before in these lectures. And that is when it's not the case that the compression is already in one of the spaces, but that the connections across the inputs are compressed into a human scale scene in the blend. So we have seen that, for example, when we were talking about dinosaurs turning into birds. Here's one dinosaur and another dinosaur, all these dinosaurs, and some of them die off, and they're different. You have analogies and disanalogies across all these inputs, and the analogies get pressed to a uniqueness, the dinosaur. And the disanalogies get compressed into change. Dinosaurs turned into birds, right? Or a fed bear is a dead bear, or our own sense of change for a personal identity, or make this envelope disappear, that's by signing up for electronic delivery, or my tax bill gets bigger every year, or my electric bill gets bigger every year. So you have electric bills, and there are differences and analogies and disanalogies. They get compressed to one tax bill, and it changes. It gets bigger. Now, no tax bill ever got bigger, but in the blend, you have one, and it gets bigger. You're not diluted, but it gives you a human-scale blend. Many become one. These things come down to human-scale participant structure, and you're not diluted, but it helps you understand the whole network. Now, I'm moving kind of fast here, but I want to point out that this is what happens in the case of most negatives. So imagine that there is a table, and there are these five chairs around it, okay? And I say, put the green tea in front of the missing chair. Well, what is the missing chair? What does that mean? Here's what it means. You may have seen the table before with six chairs, or you may have the idea that chairs should be equally spaced around the table. And so you have that idea, you have that mental space. And notice there's a difference between these two mental spaces. This one's got five chairs and this one's got six. So there's a disanalogy, right? We compress these two to one table and we bring in the chair from our concept of the table with equally spaced chairs. We bring it in. It's in the blend. It just now has a feature, and that feature is that it's absent. It's like this table is wood, this chair is metal, and this chair over here is missing. See? It has a feature. We're very used to things having features. And you can see it right there. There it is. There's the missing chair. You know where the missing chair is. Put it in front of the missing chair. Missing is now a feature. And you already have grammar for expressing properties of things. You use adjective plus noun. So in the blend, the language that you have, you don't need new language. You don't need new grammatical structure. You already have adjective plus noun. And so you make a compression by compressing cross-space connections between the inputs. This is not unusual. In Berkeley, where I did all of my work, a caffeine headache, that's the headache you have because you didn't have your morning coffee, right? So here's one scene in which you have a headache and some kind of cause, and over here you had coffee, and there's the disanalogy between these. Namely, over here there's a headache, over here there's coffee. You compress these, and now in the blend, the coffee comes in, but the disanalogy is compressed as absence of caffeine. The cause is now the absence of caffeine. That's why you have a headache. And of course, we can refer to absence of caffeine by caffeine. Caffeine here is perfectly fine for absence of caffeine. Words don't mean. Words are tools that we use to prompt somebody to put together a conceptual integration network that is meaningful. The meaningful blend here is that absence of caffeine has caused my headache. And I can prompt you to think of that by saying caffeine headache. That is not unusual. A money problem is not usually a problem of having too much money. Money problem is usually absence of money, right? Nicotine fit is not a fit because you've had so much nicotine from cigarettes. It's a fit because you haven't had a cigarette. Security problem. That's not, boy, I've got a problem. There's too much security. No. Arousal problem. Insulin coma isn't a coma that comes about because you have insulin. It's a coma that comes about because you don't have insulin. Insulin death, food emergency, honesty crisis, rice famine. This is not unusual. Compression of the disanalogy into an absence in the blend where we can suggest the absence by the noun of the thing that we use to provoke the thought of the thing. Safe beach. What's that? What is safe? Well, suppose the child is going out on the beach and you say, oh, I'm nervous about my child. And I say, it's okay, the child is safe. Or I say, it's okay, the beach is safe. Now, I can mean exactly the same thing by those two sentences. If the meaning of a sentence was the composition of the meaning of the words, and words had meanings, then the beach is safe and the child is safe should mean two very different things. But they don't, or at least they don't have to. They can mean the same thing. What I mean is, okay, there's the child going out on the beach. Now there's a hypothetical space in which the child is harmed. Okay? And I want you to make a counterfactual connection between the scene we're in and the imaginary scene in which the child gets harmed. And compress those. And now, in this scene, it's not just this scene of the child going out there. Now, in the blend, the child goes out there and there's absence of harm. And now I want you to conceive of this space as having absence of harm. And I do that by using the word safe. Now, I could say, it's highly variable, I could say the beach is safe and I mean developers will not come and ruin it. Right? I could mean many, many different things. Many. And we analyze all of these. But the point is, a word like safe or missing or there is a gap in the fence, these are specialized words that say, hi, I want you, I'm using this word here, and what I want you to do is construct an integration network in which there are disanalogies across certain input spaces that get compressed into an absence here down in the blend, right? Look, there's a gap in the fence, and you can see it. It's right there, right? And what that means is there's a space over here in which there's a piece of wood or something in the fence. And I want you to understand that in this scene, you're supposed to construe it as that's not there. This is just very standard in language. We talk about a boathouse, a houseboat, an angry man, a loud man, right? Notice the man is loud. What we really mean is we want you to put together a scene in which his voice is loud, but now the property of the voice becomes a character property of the man. Sugar-free, dolphin-safe fishing, right? In the United States, we have tuna cans that say dolphin-safe tuna. Now, this doesn't mean that it's okay for dolphin to eat it. They won't be poisoned. It means that this tuna was caught in such a way that the nets did not damage the dolphins, right? It's dolphin-safe tuna. And on it goes. Likely candidate can mean not a candidate, but somebody who is likely to be a candidate. Guilty pleasures. It's not the pleasures that are guilty. But you have certain feelings about the pleasures that you have. So it gets compressed down now to a feature of the pleasure, and so on. It's just, this is the case of outer space compression to inner space features. So there are many compression networks. There's a science to this. Let me give you an example here that I heard on the radio. At South Shore Lumber, this is a place where you buy wood, you buy lumber to build. There's a three-day weekend, right? And it's like Dragon Boat Festival, three-day holiday, right? And the store says, at South Shore Lumber on this 3 days, Memorial Day, get no sales tax Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, 4 days, okay? Now, sales tax in the United States is this. You buy something, and it has a price. But then there's another amount you pay, which is the tax, and that goes to the government. It doesn't go to the federal government. It goes to the state government. States are sovereign powers in the United States. That's why it's called the United States. Now, notice what's happening here. What's this get no sales tax? Okay? Well, it's this. We do this all the time. There's one scene in which the buyer pays the price and gets the lumber. It's the good. There's another scene in which the buyer pays the price and the buyer pays an additional amount, the sales tax, and gets the good. There's an analogy between this, of course, but there's also a disanalogy. We compress the disanalogy now into an absence. And it's a thing with a feature. And you can get it. Somebody can give it to you. You get not only the good, but you get no sales tax. It's like getting the eraser. It's a human scale scene. You really got something. Now, of course, what happens is you just didn't pay it. But the negative, the absence, becomes a feature. We do this with personal identity. I gave you the example before of a 9-year-old boy saying, if we were all chickens, you, William, would be about Elizabeth's age. That's the babysitter. You, Peyton, who was 7. Would be about Dad's age, and me, Dad, and Mom would all be dead of old age. We are all 5 alive. We are lucky we are not chickens. Now, I won't go through all the blending of ages and how it is Peyton can be Dad's age, but Dad is dead because he's dad age, right? You can figure that all out. What I want to point out is lucky. We were just sitting at the dinner table. That's what was going on. There was no lucky in the scene. But now we have this blend in which, in the blend, Mom, Dad, and Jack are dead, and Peyton and William are old. And our scene is now counterfactual with respect to that blend. And so now we are supposed to understand that in our scene we have a special feature. It's the compression of the counterfactual. Namely, now we're lucky. We have a feature. Words like lucky, accident, dent, right? Mistaken, this is a mistake. Those are little words that say, I want you to construct an integration network that has a compression of a disanalogy and to understand your current scene or understand the relevant scene in a certain way. Here's another one that was said by a child looking up at the stars and had just learned about constellations of stars and didn't understand that the constellations are already set, that you don't just make up new ones. So the child says, oh yes, I see a constellation. It's Bangshot. Bang is the noise that a cannon makes or a gun makes. Bang! It's a man, he says. He was a soldier in the Revolutionary War. All of the members of his troop were killed, and the British were starting to come in his direction. The United States was fighting the British in the Revolution. It wasn't the United States yet. The colonies were fighting the British. So he hid inside the barrel of a cannon. But then reinforcements arrived, his own people, and fired off the cannons. Now, this cannon was not lowered, so it fired him into the sky. And there he is. But he doesn't know he's dead. So he keeps running across the sky, trying to find a way back into the Revolutionary War. Okay? Now, there are the stars. They move. They're in a certain shape. Right? He's learned that constellations, you know, you have a story of a guy, and bang, there it is. Bang shot. Up he comes. And notice, every one of you understands this. And I want to point out, this is not a plausible world. It's not possible for people to be dead and operating in a certain way because they don't know they're dead. That's not possible, right? But we don't have any trouble understanding it because we are putting this together for the purpose of thinking about the sky and other kinds of things. Now, I have been talking about blends, and many of these blends feel metaphoric. And what I want to do for the rest of the time is be a bookend with this morning's talk, which was about metaphor and the need to change metaphor analysis in order to include cultural and social history and the development. I think that's right. I want to talk about other kinds of improvements of the theory of metaphor and how to do metaphor analysis. And I'm going to do that by taking a particular metaphor that we all know. Time is space, right? So we say, we're getting closer to Monday, or Monday is approaching us, right? So we all have looked at this metaphor before. And what I want to say is there are many, many blends that we could talk about that integrate time and give us big ideas. Let's just take one of these. So there was a catamaran, two men on a catamaran, two sailors, and they wanted to sail from San Francisco around the Cape of Good Hope up to Boston, because there was a world record for doing that set by a clipper ship in 1859, and they're on the catamaran in 1998 sailing a thing called Great American II. And the sailing magazine, the news magazine called Latitude 38, which is just wonderful, writes, as we went to press, Rich Wilson and Bill Bewenga, those are the two sailors on the catamaran, were barely maintaining a 4.5-day lead over the ghost of the clipper Northern Light. Now, what happens? In 1859, the clipper is moving along. In 1998... the catamaran is moving along. There's only one boat in each place. They're very different, but they get compressed into one blend that now has both boats making this run. And the boat from 1859, Northern Light, comes down, but it's not really there, so we call it a ghost. Now we can understand this as a race, and we can say things like, it's 4.5 days ahead of Northern Light. In fact, you could have just said that without ghost. Ghost marks that there's an absence in the inputs. There's really an absence in the other input space, right? Now, nobody's deluded. The guys in the catamaran the sailors do not think if they fall off in the sea that 4.5 days later the ghost of Northern Light will come by and pick them up, right? They're not confused. But they're using this in order to understand. Ads use these compressions across time. This is what it's like to be in a business seat on British Airways. This is a picture of the fall of the market, you know, the Dow, lovely while it's last, it's going to fall. So look at the compression. So now the time plot of the Dow Jones Industrial Average becomes the string of a kite, and the sky becomes the graph paper. Well, let's look at the very, very basic one, time and space. And I want to say some things that are going to be my conclusions, the things you should take away. I'll say them very quickly here just to let you know they're coming. The point is that for metaphor analysis, one of the things that we have to recognize is that conceptual products are almost never the result of a single mapping. Metaphor analysis that says here's a domain and here's a domain and we map from this domain to this domain is always a simplification of what's actually going on. These integration networks are much more complicated than that. That is true for things like time is money or time is space. Cobbling and sculpting. Integration networks are never built entirely on the fly, nor are they pre-existing conventional structures. Integration networks, underlying thought and action are always a mix. They're individual components, there are cultural components. On the one hand, cultures build networks over long periods of time, and they get transmitted over generations. But, you know, on the other hand, these people are capable of innovating in any particular context, right? So you have novel mappings, novel compressions that use entrenched compressions, right? You cobble and sculpt with these networks when you try to communicate. Compression. Now, this is a remarkable conclusion of our recent work over the last decade, and it was overlooked by both early metaphor theory, which I worked in, and by early blending theory, right? And that is that integration networks achieve systematic compressions, and there are standard ways of doing this that we use all the time to create human-scale blends. There are compression and decompression patterns in conceptual networks, and they, in many ways, make conceptual metaphors possible. Inference. Inference transfer is not the only, or maybe even the main, motivation behind a metaphor. In fact, it's quite typical for source domain inferences to be violated in the emergent blended space. This is because topologies and the multiple inputs may clash, so not everything gets projected to the blended space. On the contrary, the projection is selective, and much of what's in the blended space is not in any of the inputs because you run the blend and develop it. Remember, marrying his girlfriend was not in any of the input spaces for the man who sees himself marrying his girlfriend here. Emergent structure, the focus on single mapping and inference transfer in early metaphor theory left out many of the powers of these integration networks, in particular the ability to develop emergent structure. So we're going to see that in time and space. Okay? So here we go. Let's do a little reanalysis of the old basic metaphor of time and space. For starters, let's think of our experience of time. It's day, and the sun is up. It's like the Buddhist monk. And then it's night, and then it's another day, and then it's night, and then it's another day, and then it's night, and then it's another day. They just go on and on like that, right? Okay. Well, it's already a major compression and blend to come up with the idea of the cyclic day. Now, in the blend, we take all of these days and we compress them into one day, one conceptual day, and now it's cyclic. Because there are analogies, you know, sometimes the sun is up there, noon, 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 noon. All of those noons get compressed in the cyclic day, and now there's one noon. There's one dusk. There's one dawn, right? Because of that compression, this is very much like, for those of you who have been watching these lectures, this is very much like the mythic race with Hikam el-Gurush and all six of the races over the last six decades getting compressed into one race. This is a compression, and now there's a cyclic day. It's a conception you have, one day. And so it makes it possible to say things like, and this is good only for the blend, right? We can say things like, we've come around to noon again, right? Now notice in your experience of days, you're never at the same time again. Every time you're in is always different from every other time you were in. But now in the blend, you come back to noon again. You're at the same spot in the cyclic day. We can say this park closes at dusk. We can say it's time for your morning coffee. Why? Because across all these different mornings you have coffee. And now it comes down into the blend as one coffee. It's your morning coffee. So morning can now be a feature of the coffee. We can talk about this for other kinds of things, your weekly workout, your monthly visit to your mother, your annual checkup, right? There are many of these cycles that we create. Now, let's stick with the day, though. It's very, very useful for us to have a concept of the periodic event, something that repeats. We need an anchor in the world. Now, one of these anchors is, of course, the sun going up, right, and coming down. This is a very standard one, right? Another one is we made a watch. Now, a watch is a very bizarre thing. It's a bunch of glass and metal, and you stick it on your wrist, right? It can get broken easily. You can't eat it. It doesn't keep you warm. It doesn't hold a drink, you know. What's it good for, right? And it's got some little metal that moves around. Well, if there is a physical event that we think of as repeating, that is, there's an onset and a termination, and we can all sort of agree to this onset and termination, then we can use that and blend it with our concept of the cyclic day. And it goes like this. Here's your cyclic day. And over here is the artifact, the something, the periodic event. And noon, for example, in the cyclic day, can now correspond to something in the period that is repeated, that we think of as repeated. Now, it's quite ingenious what's happened. We made it so you could have a watch where the hand just goes around once every day. And this is noon, and when it comes around, here it's noon, or this is noon, this is noon, this is noon, this is noon, this is midnight, this is noon, this is midnight. You could do that. There are clocks like that. We have chosen instead, for various reasons that are entirely explicable, but that I won't go into, to make it so the rod goes around twice. This is noon, and this is midnight. Okay? And we can divide up the face of the clock so that when it sweeps through a certain arc, that corresponds to equal intervals of time. So the arcs are now time intervals, right? And if you look at your watch, it's divided up in beautiful ways so that you have 12 divisions of the face. This is an analog watch, by the way. 12 divisions of the face, but the little rod goes around twice. So the number of divisions is the number of times the little rod goes around in one day times the number of divisions on the face. So if it goes around, the little one goes around twice and there are 12 divisions, then there are 24 equal divisions in the day. And you can map this cyclic day onto this periodic event. And now you have a new blend. And in this blend, you now have agreed upon, you don't have time yet, but you have agreed upon universal events, like an hour. An hour corresponds to a certain interval, a certain path on that clock, right? And it's that interval is also 1/24th of the day, right? And all the hours are the same length. And we all agree, we can all agree. Now, this is amazing. Where is the hour? Can you touch it? Can you see it? Suddenly there's a universal event in the world, an abstract universal event. But hey, dancing for an hour isn't an hour, right? Running for an hour isn't an hour. Where's the hour? Well, we'll get back to that. But this gives you universal events. All right. Now, what I want to say is that there's lots of linguistic data. This, by the way, is all covered in an article Gilles Fauconnier and I wrote. It's called Rethinking Metaphor. You can get it from the Cognitive Science Network. There's lots of linguistic data that we consider. We can say 3 hours went by and then he had dinner. We can't say, most of us, 3 feet went by and he was at the door. You can say minutes are quick, but hours are slow. You can't say, though, when you're moving, inches go faster than feet. You can say those 3 hours went by slowly for me, but the same 3 hours went by quickly for him. For me, the hours were minutes, but for her, the minutes were hours. Right? You know what I mean. At the end of the 3 hours, you will have solved the problem. But at the end of the same 3 hours, he will have solved it and five more. Time came to a halt. Sure, it's Friday afternoon, but Monday morning is already staring us in the face. Next week was an eternity away. For me, the 3 hours were forever, but for her, they did not exist. It'll go by faster if you stop thinking about it. Our wedding was just yesterday. Where have all those years disappeared? Next week was an eternity away. I didn't see those years go by. You can say all of these things, except for the ones you can't say. Right? It's amazing. You have to account for this ability to talk about time in this way. And it doesn't come up by mapping time onto space. You have to do rather more than that. Okay, notice some goofy things. In the domain of space, units of measurements are not moving objects. So if I have a foot, a ruler, it doesn't move. I don't look out in the world and see feet and yards and meters flying by. Units of measurement are not moving objects. And the blend, units of measurement, hours, days, are. They move. Units of measurement move. In the domain of space, observers are not at the same location, and they're not looking in the same direction. So right here in space, I'm looking over here. I'm looking at you, but you're looking at me. We're not in the same place, and we're not looking at the same things. Right? But in the blend, we are all at the same temporal location, and we're all looking in the same direction, and we're seeing the same universal events, right? So in the blend, everyone sees the same moving objects. That is, they see the same hours, right? They perceive them. In the domain of space, not all moving objects are on the same path, but in our understanding of time, all of these moving objects, the hours that are coming, Monday that's coming at us, Tuesday that's coming at us, or we're approaching Monday, or we're approaching Tuesday, all of the events are on the same path, right? Big clashes between time and space. In the domain of space, observers in the same location looking at the same direction would see not only the same moving objects, but the same speeds. But in the blend, that's not what we see. For her, Monday is coming rapidly, because on Monday she takes the test. But for me, it's coming very slowly, because I'm going on vacation Monday, and I want it to get here, but it won't, right? In the domain of space, all objects moving along a path exist, and the closer ones are perceived as closer. But for time, the ones that are farther away can seem closer. You can say that they're closer. And so on and so forth. In the domain of space, you cannot speed up or slow down the speed of moving objects by the quality of your attention. But in the blend, you can change the speed of the events by what kind of attention you pay them. Okay, how does this happen? Here's the analysis. There's a big domain of events. It's just events. We experience them. For instance, there's this lecture. This is an event. We're here. This is happening. Right? The wind is blowing. There are events. Human beings are really expert at parsing the world into events and objects. That's what we do. We look at the world, we see events and objects. Now, this is pretty bizarre because notice your visual field is not parsed into events and objects. You don't see events and objects in separate places. All events have objects, and objects are involved in events, right? And moreover, it's not even clear that the objects are parsed. You have to do that. The world doesn't come with labels. But we're expert at this. Neurobiologically, that's just what we do. We are mammals. And so we'll just take it as given that that can happen. Now, this expertise involves the understanding of event shape. That is, things are getting closer, ordering. This one is before that one, temporally. And we refer to them, right? Event spaces can include subjective experience. So an event can be pleasant. It can bore us. It can be painful. It can be frightening. So for instance, in a lecture, the lecture might be fun for me and boring for you and challenging for the technician who has to run the camera and so on, right? We can all have different subjective experiences of the events. In the same event at different times we can have subjective experience of, right? So then there it goes. Now there's another space, there's another kind of knowledge. This is a very important kind of event for human beings, and that's motion through physical space from a point A to a point B. We are human beings. We are mammals. Boy, do we understand this. We are built to understand this. An object moves through space from a point A to a point B. Okay. With corresponding objective and subjective experiences as you're doing that. Let's call this is a subset of E. This is a subset of events. This is a particular kind of event. So the input of experienced motion through physical space. And we'll call it X. And there are a lot of correlations. If we travel from A to B and then B to C, we know that the event of traveling from A to B is over before the event of traveling from A to C is over. This is part of our experience of moving in space. This comes from our ability to order events. So all else being equal, the relative length of the motion corresponds to the ordering of events. AB is shorter than AC. The event AB is over before the event AC. Now, in this space, we have a notion of fast and slow, and it's not the one we use in physics. So we can say that AB is faster. Going from A to B is faster than going from A to C, even if we move at the same speed on those two paths. So I can say, oh, it's faster to walk across the street than to walk to the bakery. Even though, if you know, you're going at 1 mile an hour in both cases. The fast in that domain can correspond to the length of the event or the time interval of the event. So that's just a way we use the word fast, right? We can use the word fast. And so in X, in this conception, the event of traversing the path is connected with the path. Okay, now we blend these. And this blending is what has sometimes been called events or actions or the event structure metaphor. So we can understand any event as a blend with moving along a path. So now in the same sort of way that I can go through the park, which is an X, right? This is somebody moving along a path. Now I can go through the lecture because it's an event, and it is an event that isn't moving along a path, but I blend it with moving along a path, and now all events can take on the structure or some of the structure of the event of moving along a path through space. This one is pretty familiar to everybody, right? So this gives us the ability to talk about going through a lecture, going through the book, going through, we can go through events. We can come to the end of the lecture. We can come to the end of the party, right? We can go through them just the way we can come to the limit of the park, okay? And this one's pretty common. So now remember our wonderful network for the cyclic blended day and the periodic physical event, we get blended. So now in the blend, we have universal events like ours that are thought of as parts of the cyclic day and indicated by the position on the physical periodic event. So I'm going to stop using this just for the sake of simplicity because these networks are going to get pretty big. We'll just use C for the cyclic day, A for the artifact, the thing in the world that has a periodic motion, and M for the blend that gives you hours. Well, now, of course, we can blend again. And this is where we get time. This is the first spot in the network in which you get time, by which I mean events, every local event, every particular event is also a universal event. I'll explain that. Here in M, there are hours. Here, there are events that are blended with the particular event of movement from A to B along a path. Now, when we blend these, It's very easy to do because, of course, we have all of these wonderful event connections across all these kinds of things. Now, every event from this understanding is also an event in this understanding. So now, if my lecture, when I am going through the lecture, right? I'm going through the event, this particular event that we are all experiencing. Now, I am also going through the hour. I am now going through minutes. Where are these minutes? They're universal events, and every particular event is also inside a universal event. And in fact, this hour that I am going through when I go through the lecture is the same hour that you are going through when you are going through the lecture. It's the same hour that that person out there is going through, even though they are going through a very different event. But we now have an understanding of our world, according to which there are universal units of measurement for time, just the way they are for space. So, for instance, it's not possible for this thing to have length but no measure. It's got to take up so many meters, right? Because there are universal units of length. And if you have any length of all, at all in a particular spot in the world, then you have a universal measure. So this length here has to go through so many millimeters or centimeters. These are universal units of measurement. You don't have length in the world without it also occupying a universal unit of length. Now, similarly for time, you can't have an event that is a special event that is not also inside the universal event. Our event of the lecture is in the hour from 4 to 5. Right? Now, every event over here where there's subjective experience also is inside a universal event, which is a unit of measurement. We all go through the day. We all go through the hour. We all go through the minute. And in fact, it's not even people. All events, like the falling of the leaves in the tree, go through the hour. And it can take an hour for the water to drain out of the bucket. Now you have universal events down here. So you can say things like, I went through the first hour much more quickly than the second hour. Now notice, from the M space, where it's always the same hour, we agree, we stipulate, that it's objectively universal. It's the same in the sense that an hour is an hour. But over here from E, where we have subjective experience, it can feel to me differently in the local event. The first hour can feel very different to me. That is, if I lecture for 2 hours, let me put it like this. If the first half of the lecture seems to me very zippy, and the second half of the lecture seems to me, you know, grindy and challenging, I can say, I went through the first half of the lecture much more quickly than I went through the second half of the lecture. Now, I could mean that they're taking different amounts of time, but I can also mean they take exactly the same amount of universal time, but that my experience of that time is very different. So, you can even use both of them at the same time. It's amazing how the 8-hour week, that's from M, that's the universal measurement, right? There's a week and there's an 8-hour day. It's amazing how the 8-hour work day, so that's universal, is longer on Monday than it is on Friday. Now that's not working here because it's Sunday, it's a work day or something like that, but you know, Monday is when you start work after the weekend in the United States, and Friday is when you end work. So people constantly say things like, you know, Monday is dragging, Monday is longer than Friday, and so on. Now, we agree because of M that it's the same universal time. They're both 8 hours. That's from M. But the subjective experience from E is now that one of them is longer than the other. We can use them both at the same time. And what I want to say here is we need a way to distinguish this. So one of these blends takes the subjective experience from our subjective experience of events, and another one takes the topology from the universal events of the hours. Now notice, we've got a lot of compression and blending going on here in order to get just the basic structure we need for some of the most basic ways that people talk about time. Right? Very complicated. So let's suppose we're exploiting the projection from M, which is the universal measurements of time that took us so much work to get. So you ask how long it took me to go through the lecture, and I say, I went on too long. It was 1 hour and 5 minutes long. Okay, it's too long, and I'm using the universal event with the objective topology, right? Now, you ask me how long it took me to go through the lecture, and I say, I went on too long. It took me centuries. Now, that's not false. What you understand that to mean is that the subjective experience of that 1 hour and 5 minutes felt as if it was going very slowly. So again, it's amazing how the 8-hour workday is longer on Monday than it is on Friday. The person who says this is not crazy. And we don't say, oh, you couldn't possibly be a human being because you're saying what's false. And we already have on the basis of things that we pretty much already know. Remember that 1 hour with your parents is faster for me than it is for you. Okay? Imagine a married couple and they have to go and have, you know, dinner with her parents or something. And the husband says, remember, 1 hour with your parents goes faster for me than it does for you. That's one kind of scene. He could have also said, if the subjective psychology and experience was different, remember that 1 hour with your parents is faster for you than it is for me. Now, he's not saying that the universal events of hours that took us so much work to construct varies for them. No, he's admitting that in M, it's the same objective amount of time. But in E, it is a different speed for them. Okay? Now, of course, as is well known in metaphor theory, there is a dual for motion. So, for example, if I'm on a train and I'm actually going through the forest, I can say, you know, I'm going past the trees. I'm going by the trees. But given that these things are relative, so as the terminology is, you can choose as your reference point either an ego who is stationary or an ego who's moving. And the other objects can be stationary or moving. You can say either, I went by the trees, or the trees went by. This is a dual in X. Now remember, X is motion on a path from A to B. And it can be that I am going by the objects, or that the objects are going by me. This is not a matter of scientific, you know, truth. Yes, of course, we have a conception that the trees don't move. That's not the point. The point is, how are you conceiving it without being deluded? So I can say the old toll house went by. The old toll house already went by. The rough stretch of road went by. The forest went by. So this is relative motion. And I can even give you my subjective experience of this motion. That stretch of road went by effortlessly. The first 5 miles went by effortlessly. These are just normal things to say. But now, of course, when I blend my dual of motion with the much bigger domain of events that we experience, we get the blend, well known from metaphor theory, in which I can not only say the first 5 miles, or you know, the trees went by, those are the objects, and the universal measurements of length, the first 5 miles or the first 5 meters went by effortlessly. Now when I blend that motion dual with events, I can say the lecture went by effortlessly. So you're sitting in the audience and you say, hey, was it really, you know, tough listening to Turner? You say, no, the lecture went by effortlessly, you know. Or the party went by pleasantly. These are not regarded as highly creative, bizarre things to say. On the contrary, they're just normal. Why? Because you develop, cultures have developed, an elaborate integration network in which you can integrate events with motion along a path. But now, just as we saw before, when we had the blend of events with moving along a path, and we have the blend of, well, first we make the cyclic day, which is a compression, so we can say noon comes round again, I'm having my morning coffee, and so on. And you blend that with the artifact that is a periodic event, like the watch. So now you get universal measurements of time. You can then blend those two things, right? So just in case anybody's getting... my clicker's in my hand. It's like your glasses are on your face. So remember back here, we had M, which is the blend of the cyclic day, or the cyclic anything, with the periodic event. And you could blend M with your blend of events and motion along a path from A to B, and you could get a blend in which now, just as you go through the forest, just as you go through the lecture, now you can go through the hour, and you have the amazing emergent property that in all the individual events we're doing, we're all going through the same hour, because every individual event is also part of a universal event, right? We have universal measurements for time. We can blend those, and that's why I can say things like, I went through the first hour much more quickly than the second hour. And we could take the topology from E or from M, so it's subjective or it's objective. We can do both simultaneously without contradicting ourselves. Now, in just the same way, we have the dual for the motion. So the trees go by instead of my going by the trees, and the lecture can go by, just as I can go through the lecture, because I'm blending with the dual, the party can go by. Now I can blend that blend of the event with the motion dual with my M, where I have universal measurements of time. And now down here, in the same way that previously I could go through the hour, now the hour can go by. Now the universal event can move. Remember I said at the beginning, in the domain of time, the way you think of it, units of measurements can move. But in the domain of space, that's not the way it is. Remember, I came up with all those enormous clashes between your experience of space and your experience of time. So I can say Friday always goes by faster than Monday. In that case, I'm using the subjective topology from the event domain. And I'm using the dual of motion. Okay? The hour sped by for him, but dragged by for me. It took centuries for the hour to pass. These are not nonsense. You know how to interpret them, right? Those 3 hours went by slowly for me, but the same 3 hours went by quickly for him. And you know what I mean. Now, if I instead use the topology of M, which has got the objective topology, with the dual of motion along a path, so now the things are going by me instead of my going by them, and our event domain, now I can say minutes go by faster than hours, right? Because this is the one where we all agree, or we, by convention, the same hour will go by whether you are suffering or having fun, right? The units of measurement move, they move past you, that's the dual, And their topology is coming from the universal objective event space that we've constructed. Okay. So, you can have both. There was a guy who was waiting for word about his friend, Michael, who was missing in a bomb detonation in London in July 2005. And I saw the interview on CNN. And they were asking him how it's going. He's waiting to hear. You know, have they found the friend who was in the building that blew up? You know, is the guy all right? Is he not all right? He's waiting. And he says, well, time goes by really slowly. At the same time, it goes by really fast. Right? Because he's got this subjective experience, or one way to interpret this, given the network that you have, is he's got this subjective experience that he's not hearing, and he's not hearing, and he wants to be hearing, and it's very painful. On the other hand, time is going by, and the more time goes by, the less likely it is to hear from his friend. So he doesn't want the time to go by, right? So he's having these conflicting subjective experiences of the time. Okay, more networks. Independently, we have the notion of retrieval of memory as blended with distance and space. So we can talk about unearthing our memory or bringing a memory a long way up back to the surface or having to reach far to get that memory and so on. That's an independent blend. But we can, of course, combine that with this one and we can talk about the way in which memory is part of the network of our experience of time. But in fact, there are more basic ones. One of the things we know from the space of M is that this time, is this constraint that we all have to go through the same hour, that's a constraint. And we can personify it. Now we can make an agent out of that constraint, and we can give that agent a name like time. Time drives us forward through the events, right? Time can force us to move. Time marches on. Time waits for no man. Never fear, time will carry them along. And, you know, the hour used to be a way that you could refer to the time. Come what come may, time and the hour runs through the roughest day. You can personify this constraint. Here's the one for a memory being close or distant, far apart, hard to access. So you can talk about calling up things from the depth of your memory, bringing a forgotten event to the surface. Well, you can bring in this recall, this RS, this is memory recall blended with space. I know I'm going a little fast here. With your existing dual of blend of motion through space with universal events and subjective experience. And now you can say things like, our wedding was just yesterday. And what you mean is that the memory is very close. The memory is very close in the sense that the amount of time that seems to you subjectively to have elapsed between them is very small. That's what it would mean to be just yesterday. Our wedding was just yesterday. Where have all those years disappeared? Or the years have really gone by fast. That is, you have to account for the fact that you know that in the M space, the objective topology is it was 18 years. You've been married 18 years. But your experience is that it wasn't anything like 18 years. So you have to account for that. Well, when you're moving in space, suppose you're on a train and you're going from A to B and you get to B it takes much less time than you were expecting. You could conclude that, oh, B is a lot closer to A than you thought. Or you could conclude that the train is going a lot faster than you thought. So you can resolve this conflict in the blend by indicating that, oh, you know, they're much closer because the years aren't really there, they disappeared, or they're much closer because the years really went by fast. I know this is going a little quickly here, but notice, everything that I'm saying here, the years went by really fast, that's absolutely standard and basic for you. You don't have any trouble understanding that. And when somebody says that to you, you don't have to stop and think. Following what's going on looks like, you know, solving partial differential equations. But that's because almost all conceptualization and thought and inference is happening in backstage cognition. It takes a ton of work. You're running it all the time. And the only thing that pops into consciousness is little reactions, little products. So the fact that it feels easy to you doesn't mean anything. because consciousness sees very, very little. You don't see how you walk. You don't see how you see. You can't call these things into consciousness, and most of what you're doing in language you can't call into consciousness too, either. We are trying to use special mental powers not meant to do this kind of analysis, to do this kind of analysis, to surface things that you do all the time but that you don't know that you do and that you are not really designed in order to solve. Okay, so the big network so far looks like this. Now notice, as I said at the beginning, conceptual constructions are never a simple mapping from one space to another, right? This is one of the big pieces of news for metaphor analysis. That was great work. It showed a lot of things. But even for the most basic metaphors, like time is space, time is money, and so on, there are always a lot of mappings going on, many more than people thought, partly because they're taking certain kinds of things just for granted as not needing construction. Now I'm going to give you an example of innovation. Okay? This was noted by Nathaniel Smith, and it's a passage from a memoir, Emily's Diary, November 5th, 1913, King of Morning, Queen of Day. Remarkable. When I'm sitting on a cushion on the floor, busy with scissors and glue pot, the time just vanishes. This is somebody who's making a scrapbook up in the attic. Okay? That's the experience. Up in the attic where all the old things are, making a scrapbook. Before I note it, the latticed rectangle of pale autumn sunlight has moved from the left wall across the floor to the other wall. And Mrs. O'Carolan is calling me for supper. Perhaps time is flowing faster up there in the attic. Perhaps the accumulated mass of the past gathered there is pulling time out of the future faster, like weight on a line. Or perhaps, more mundanely, it is only that I'm getting older every year and that it is the accumulated weight of time behind me that is unreeling the years with ever-increasing speed. What a horrible thing it must be to grow older and find that ever-decreasing number of years hurrying you faster, faster toward your grave, as if time were impatient to be rid of you. Now, the point of this is you can understand all of it because every piece of it is using structure that is already in the network I showed you for your everyday expressions about time. There's a little more exploitation. So, for instance, in physics, we know a bigger weight pulls harder, and you're up there in the attic, and so the accumulated mass of memories gets blended with the mass of physical stuff so it can pull time faster. There's a personification of time here. This is time hurries you, only now it's hurrying you faster. The latticed rectangle is a periodic event, the shadow. See, the sun shines on the lattice, and it moves across the room, and it does the same thing every day. That's a timepiece, and you can map it to your watch. Okay, so you'd look at this, and as I say, this is all in an article by Gilles Foucault and Mark Turner called Rethinking Metaphor. It's in the handbook of the Cambridge Handbook of Metaphor, newly out. You can also get it from the Cognitive Science Network, and you can see all these analyses. But it's not this particular analysis of this particular metaphor that is important. In fact, we chose it because everybody sort of thought that this metaphor had been thoroughly analyzed and we were done. And in general, the points that I'm making for this basic conceptual metaphor are true, as far as I can tell, for all conceptual metaphors that people analyze. Namely, conceptual products are never the result of a single mapping. What we've come to call conceptual metaphors turn out to be mental constructions involving many spaces and many mappings in elaborate networks constructed by means of overarching general principles that come with conceptual integration. And these conceptual integration networks are far richer than the bundles of pairwise mappings that have been considered in most theories of metaphor. We regard this as an advance in the theory of metaphor, indeed, theory of metaphor that we did a lot of work to develop. Cobbling and sculpting, and this goes back to what we heard this morning about the role of culture and social construction in these metaphors. Integration networks are never built entirely on the fly, nor are they pre-existing conventional structures entirely. Integration networks' underlying thought and action are always a mix. On the one hand, cultures build networks over generations. Over long periods of time, they get transmitted down generations. And techniques for building particular networks also get transmitted culturally. But people are capable of innovating in any context because they're using the same methods to innovate that created the conceptual metaphors to begin with. It's the same process. And that's why we can change them. Because in making them in this moment, we're doing just the process that created them to begin with. The result is that integration networks consist of conventional parts, conventionally structured parts, and novel mappings and compressions. Compression, as I said, a remarkable conclusion of the work over the last 10 years, 15, is that, and this was overlooked by early metaphor theory and by early blending theory. It was overlooked by Gilles Fauconnier and Mark Turner in the early years when we were the only two blenders, right? We didn't see it the way we needed to see it. Is that integration networks achieve systematic compressions that make it possible for us to manage the network. The ability to use standard techniques and patterns of compression and decompression enables us to work at once over elaborate integration networks. So I won't go into it because you've seen these examples in the previous five examples. Metaphor has overarching goals other than the projection of inference. And in many cases, the crucial inferences that are projected are largely driven by the target rather than the source. And there are plenty of metaphoric blends that are really crucial and really important, but the important thing is not inference in some of those cases. We had to start off saying it was inference because we had the rational paradigm according to which the only way you could get certain people in cognitive science to listen to you is if you showed these conceptual mappings were important for reasoning. That's, by the way, why I start with the Buddhist monk. I say there's a riddle, and there's a solution to this riddle, and it looks kind of mathematical, and you can't get it without blending. And that's why I do it, because audiences say, ah, I see, I have to do this in order to reason about truth, so I better pay attention. And so it's understandable sociologically that we always started off with inference, but in fact, that's not all that's happening. Emergent structure. The focus on single mapping and inference transfer in early metaphor theory left out many of the powers of integration networks, in particular, the ability to develop emergent structure. Okay? Time is space is nothing if not a network that creates emergent structure and emergent concepts that were not available in the original input spaces. Thank you.